I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
And welcome to the Motor Mouth Podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
Do you work for or run a business? You can now raise awareness and funds for urgent change by joining the Brain Tumor Charity's brand new campaign, Businesses Against Brain Tumors. By declaring yourself a business against brain tumors and taking on your very own Brain Power Challenge, you can raise funds for vital medical research while improving your own brain health at the same time. People have shaped our world and facilitated amazing amounts of progress through business. Organizations are connecting people every day, innovating in the face of challenges like the pandemic and creating products that make up our culture. Now is the time to take that power and put it into good by beating brain tumors. And we all know there's power in numbers. Brain tumors are still the biggest cancer killer of children and adults under 40, with treatments having changed very little since the 1980s. It's no wonder when only 3% of national cancer research funding is spent on brain tumors. So it's down to the charity and its community of amazing supporters to urgently enact change. Look for the Brain Tumor Charity on social media to find out how you, your colleagues, and your business can be the difference we need to see to defeat brain tumors for good. Motormouth is proud to be officially partnered with the Brain Tumor Charity, so a huge thank you for your support. If you can donate anything, you can also do that through the motormouth.club website or through the Brain Tumor Charity direct, and together we can help every single person affected by a brain tumor. It's season 9 and we're really excited to be teaming up with Roding Cars. Based in New Zealand but with a new HQ open in Donington Park in the UK, owning the Rodin FZ gives you the keys to experience a whole new level of driving performance. A supercar like no other, giving you the chance to feel pure driving pleasure. Designed for easy maintenance, you could own the F1 lifestyle and strive for that perfect lap time with the Rodin FZ. There's plenty of purchasing options, including after-sale partnership, where your Rodin FZ is looked after on and off track by an official Formula Racing team, storage, and exclusive track access to Rodin's very own circuit in New Zealand. With Rodin and the Rodin FZ, you experience so much more than just owning an open-wheel high-performance supercar. For more information on Rodin and how you can get involved, visit rodin-cars.com.
Hello, my name's Tim Sylvie, and sadly, my usual and lofty co-host Harry is on holiday today with terrible Wi-Fi, so I'm flying solo, but nevertheless, the show must go on. And today, I'm joined by a man who was born in leafy Wimbledon. Now, we all know that Wimbledon is famous for its tennis, but did you know that it's the oldest tournament in the world, dating back to 1877, where it was first played at Warple Road and was open to amateurs? Yes, you and I could have had a crack at winning it. In other Wimbledon-related facts, there are 54,000 tennis balls used in the tournament today, which are kept refrigerated to keep them looking spotless and playing perfectly. But enough of my Wimbledon-based facts. It's time to bring in today's guest, and I'm delighted to be joined by David Brabham, a man from one of the most important racing dynasties in motorsport. He's had over 30 years in the sport, from karts to single-seaters, Formula One and sports cars. He has a ridiculous racing CV. He's a triple Le Mans 24-hour class winner, back-to-back American Le Mans Series champion. He's enjoyed two championship titles in ALMS. He's been a WEC LMP1 privateer, picking up podiums. And we've not even touched on the triumphs in Japanese GT500s, USA Professional Sports Car Championship, Spa 24, Daytona 24, Sebring 12 Hours, and Bathurst 1000. In recent history, he's brought the famous Brabham name back with Brabham Automotive with the astonishing BT62 machine. We're here to hear about his life, career, thoughts and opinions. David Brabham, welcome to the Motor Mouth
Podcast. Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. That's quite an intro. Thank you. Well, I sit there and I go, wow, did I do all that?
I know, it's amazing. it's probably the most impressive racing CV we've had. But where are you joining us from today? Where's home these days?
I'm just in the Banbury area. Kind of in Motorsport Valley as such.
Very nice. Yeah, that sort of... like you say, Motorsport Valley, a lot of the F1 teams around there, a lot of other teams, and Silverstone not too far away. Now, before we get cracking, I must explain that you're actually kindly joining us on the 31st of March next year at our celebrity charity karting event, which we're doing in partnership with Movember and the Brain Tumor Charity. And if our listeners haven't found it already, there's an auction site up and running where you can actually bid on a team to join that race and be partnered with David. So David will be in the team. He's been volunteered by a mutual friend of ours, David Murray Hunley, the grumpy entrepreneur. If you want to join David on track, you can do so. Head over to our socials or head over to our website and you can find some information about that day and join David racing against a bunch of other pro drivers and celebrities. So make sure to check that out. Now, David, we always go back to the start. Let's talk about when the racing bug first bit you. I mean, you were born and then introduced to a car, presumably. Your father, Sir Jack, has his place in F1 fame as a driver and team owner. Take us back to your earliest memories of the sport.
Obviously, just touched on the fact that I grew up, obviously, in a sort of, let's call it a famous racing family, and racing was just, that was the topic. That's what everybody really discussed. But, my dad retired when I was five, went to from England to Sydney. So he kind of essentially went back home. And I grew up there up until the age of 13. And yes, my dad actually retired and then sort of went off and did touring car races a few years later. So I got to see some of the racing, but it really wasn't an interest as such. My passion at that time was football, soccer.
Okay. I was just going to say, so you've moved to Australia very, very young, so 5 years old. So you stayed there for a number of years. Presumably, if England versus Australia on the cricket or the rugby is on, you're an Aussie fan?
Yeah, I would say I'm more of an Aussie fan. I arrived there when I was five. I left to come back to the UK when I was sort of 22. So I spent quite a lot of my childhood there. And a lot of those memories sort of really embed you into the country. So when it comes to sport, I'll support Australia. I do support England with football as well. I'm a Man United fan, but I support any English club fighting it out in Europe, you know. So I'm more of a football fan than, let's say, just one club.
Yeah.
I just love football, and wanted to be a footballer as a kid. And I played okay. You know, we had a great little team and, you know, we choked at every final. We won the first one and then we were runners up four years in a row and, you know, we just choked it. Yeah. At the end. But it was a great period. And then I got sent off to an agricultural boarding school to learn about agriculture because we had a farm. So essentially I was being groomed to be a farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't play football. They played Aussie rules football. And I was quite sporty as a kid, so I loved all sports, got involved in all sports, represented the school in whatever sport I could do, whether it was running, athletics, you know, long distance. I used to love long distance running, so I did quite a bit of that. Table tennis, you name it, whatever I could play sport, that was my big thing. And I learned how to play Aussie rules,
insane.
Which was great fun.
Insane
yeah, which
sport.
Is insane, yeah. Insane game.
Yeah.
So my football, let's say dream sort of that disappeared. And to be frank, I was good, but I wasn't that good. my life was sort of headed towards farming. So on the farm in Australia, there was no motorsport. So I was really quite removed from the industry as such, and the conversations. So
What was the thinking behind that as a family? Because obviously your siblings, your father, you know, you've got this motorsport dynasty. Was it just you were sort of pushed down that route because basically someone needed to look after the farm?
Yeah, I think there's an element. There's two things. I think Dad wasn't that keen on all these boys going racing. We had a farm. I showed no interest in racing, so it just kind of seemed a natural thing for me to go that route. It's not something I, you know, woke up every day and go, great, I'm going to learn all about sheep today, you know, but it was just part of something I went through. I left school at 16 to work on my family farm, but also go to a wool classing college in the nearest town. But at that point, I also went to America for 3 months to watch my older brother, Jeff, race. And he was doing IndyCars for the first time in 1982. And for me, that was the first time I really kind of went, wow, this is cool. This is racing. And I can remember being quite interested, although I wasn't mechanical like my father, I was interested in how things worked. Mm. And so I'd be in the briefings with my brother. I was generally helmet carrier, but I kind of liked the fact that I could sit in there and listen and kind of learn, you know, learn something quite new and different. And then he went off to do a Can-Am race because he'd won the Can-Am championship the year before and he was going to help Ella Unser Jr. try and win the Can-Am title. I went over with him to do a seat fitting in the Frisbee that was being racing at the time and saw a go-kart in the corner. Someone was working on it. I wandered over there. And on the farm, I had a go-kart with my neighbour, but it was, you know, it was like we built it ourselves. It had a Brixton Stratton engine on it, and it was just a bit of fun, you know. And then when I was talking to the guy, I asked a really lame question. I said, do people race go-karts? I had no idea, absolutely no idea people race go-karts. And I was 16, 17 years of age. So I remember the bloke turning around and asking me if I was adopted. It's like he couldn't work it
fair
out.
Fair comment,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was fair. And so I kind of, the bug bit me right then. That was the moment my path changed because I went back to Australia and I grabbed my neighbour and I said, hey, we should go and have a look at go-kart racing. So we went off to a go-kart race meeting, which was at the time the biggest race meeting of that racetrack all year. It was the New South Wales Country Titles. There were carts everywhere, Castrol R smell. You know, you're kind of hooked as soon as you got in there. Went and chatted to Dad about it. His face just went white.
Yeah.
He just could not believe it. So I thought, well, fine, I'm not getting any help from him. So I went to my neighbour who I went to school with and said, let's put our money together and go go-karting. And we did. We put our money together. We bought a secondhand go-kart. And off we went.
And were you immediately? I mean, you're starting racing at a late age. I know now it's mad. Like kids start karting at 5, 6 years old and spend a freaking fortune on it. But you're starting what 16, 17, even 18 years old.
Yeah, 17.
So did you get in? Were you immediately quick? Did you have a natural affinity with a go kart even at that early stage?
I would say I did, and that was mainly because on the farm, having grown up driving for a very long time, as a young kid driving on the farm. But also I drove flat out and sideways. I should have been a rally driver if I think of all the stuff I used to get up to on the farm. But it was a great place to, and I didn't know it at the time, where I was actually training myself.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, feeling on the dirt, you know, feeling the grip, the balance, I didn't know how to race at that point because I'd never done racing. But in terms of driving fast, that never worried me. And I had a natural feel for it.
Yeah.
So when I got in the go-kart, you know, dad was a bit like, "Phew, okay, where'd that come from?" You know, it was a bit of a surprise. And the racing side of it, I learned a lesson very early on because I ended up, I did a couple of heats and I was doing okay. And then I got past someone on one lap and then went to get past another one on a long left-hand corner and the bloke went wide. And I thought, well, I got the other bloke last time, so I'll do him on the inside. And then he came back in front of me. I touched wheels with him and over I went. And I ended up, you know, I only was racing with a pair of jeans and a jumper. That was it. No race suit, no nothing, you know. And my jumper came up as I'm rolling on the tarmac and my back was complete, all the flesh had come off the back.
Jesus Christ.
So I ended up in hospital, wrapped up like a mummy. And, that was a very valuable lesson.
Yeah.
In two things, really, I guess, in terms of predicting when to take a move and when not to, but also, it can hurt. And also, I guess that it didn't stop me. And that was, I think dad thought that was it. I would have been, that's it. David's not going to be interested anymore. But I got back in the go-kart and off I went again.
Please tell me you bought yourself a race suit.
Yeah, well, I think, I did some racing and dad could see that I could drive. And then he said, well, he sat me down. He said, well, are you serious about this? And I said, well, yeah, I am, this is what I feel like I want to do. So I said, okay, well, I'll help you buy a new go-kart, a new engine, cause I had secondhand stuff. So, and I was punching above my weight with what I had in a way. And then got the new go-kart and, started to win more regularly. And that's when dad, I think it was at Orange. I did a race at Orange. My very first time at racing at Orange, I ended up getting lapped. I just didn't know what I was doing. It was wet, absolutely pouring with rain. My engine wasn't running properly. It was all sorts of problems. The next time I went back to Orange, I won by half a lap.
Wow.
And he was there and he's, and it was half drizzly, half, so it was tricky conditions. We were on slicks. And that was the time where he told me. So that was the time I went, okay, you've got something here. We need to see what we can do with it. So that was when he really got behind me. But I had to prove to him that I was serious about it and I could actually do it.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, father son racing, and there are obviously some sons out there who have a go at it and don't have that natural ability. Do you think there is something inherently in certain people that may be passed down that makes them good at racing? And not necessarily something, something simple, but it could be something within their psyche or their mentality that they've inherited that makes them better than the average man.
That's a really tricky question, isn't it? If you really dive into the detail, yeah. But I think on the surface you could easily say, I think there is a natural thing that's in people when they're born. It's like that's one of the gifts they've got. It doesn't mean to say that gives you success, because we've seen a lot of very talented people make the wrong decisions and then not really have a career. Where we've seen guys that perhaps don't have the natural ability as some of the others, but they work damn hard at it and they succeed. Yeah. So it's not just, oh, here's your natural talent and off you go, it's going to be easy. You still have to work hard, be dedicated as you are, because the guy next to you wants to beat you, or the girl next to you wants to beat you. It's just simple as that. So, you hear about people picking up a tennis racket or a cricket bat at an early age and they've just got the eye and the rhythm and it's just there.
Yeah.
It's how you harness it after that. So when I started driving and driving as quickly and as stupidly as I did on the farm, you know, driving fast was very comfortable.
Yeah. You know? It's a fascinating thing to think about. I mean, it seems to be there's, you know, you've either got to have some talent, or you've got to be incredibly hardworking, or you've got to have absolutely bottomless pits of cash. And it becomes a bit of a, you know, you do it as a hobby. And I could name several drivers that I've even worked with who perhaps don't have that natural ability, but do have the benefit of having millions of pounds in the bank and can effectively buy themselves into the sport. But fast forward a little bit and you're back in the UK, 1989, racing against the likes of Alan McNish, who's someone you'd come up against throughout your career. British F3, you've beaten the likes of Michael Schumacher in the process. Things are going pretty well. Take us through that stage of your career. You must be thinking then things are really heading in a positive direction.
Yeah, I mean, 1989 in F3 was, you know, a stellar year for me, having won the British F3 Championship and Macau in the same year. That gave me the super license to go to Formula One when I won Macau, which is what we were really gunning for. And I got signed up to do Formula 3000 with Middlebridge. They had a good team, good car combination with the Lola Tickford engine. And I was, you know, I was pretty happy. You know, I was in a really good place. Obviously we did a great job in F3 with Bowman and myself and did what we needed to do there. And then I'm heading into Formula 3000. I thought, you know what, a couple of years in Formula 3000 and then, you know, then hopefully I'll be knocking on the door for F1.
A quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, Rodin Cars. Rodin are a bespoke formula-style supercar manufacturer based in New Zealand. With their vehicle offering, this is the only place where you can truly live the F1 lifestyle. With the easy-to-run, easy-to-maintain, and even easier-to-drive Rodin FZ, you can live the dream of hunting down those final tenths of lap time whilst being fully supported by the team at Rodin, who will provide you with after-sale care, storage options, exclusive use of their incredible track in New Zealand, and courtesy of Formula Racing Team Tech Grand Prix will run, set up and maintain your vehicle on and off the track. The Rodin FZ is a vehicle like no other, perfect for any true car aficionado in search for that elite performance. To find out more, head to rodin-cars.com.
But things changed after between Macau and the first race of the F3000 season. A lot changed. So Middlebridge bought Brabham Formula One team. The week of Phoenix, which was round one of the 1990 World Championship, that week, out of the blue, I get a call from the team saying, how would you like to come over and do Phoenix and race the Brabham in the race, you know? And I went, I thought about it and I went, you know what? No, thank you. I didn't feel I was ready. I didn't feel I was physically ready. Having driven an F3000, done a couple of tests in it, or Formula One was another huge step. I just, you know, that week going to a new track, new team, new car, I just didn't think I was ready. So I said no. And then we were ready to go for our first test with the new cars. And the team said, right, we're cancelling the 3000 program. I was going to be teammates with Damon Hill. He was out of a job. I was out of a job, and then they said, we want you to be in Formula One. And then all of a sudden I was a Formula One driver.
That's insane, isn't it? I mean, it's mad how quickly things progressed for you at that stage. And it's been well publicized that, you know, Formula One didn't necessarily go to plan for you, but did you enjoy, how do you look back at it now? I mean, amazing that you got there. Did you have a chance to enjoy that first stint in Formula One at all?
I would say it was much more of a struggle than I thought it would be. I knew it'd take time just to get up to speed. What I didn't realise at the time was how bad a state Brabham was in financially. We had, you know, they ran out of money, basically, and we had to, I didn't even know we were going to get to him like the next race until someone paid for the engines, you know. So I'd walk into the workshop and go, why are you guys still here? You know, well, we're waiting for someone to pay for the engines. Cool. You know, it's just like that every race, you know what I mean? So it was a pretty horrible environment, like that, a lot of pressures. And, you know, obviously I'm up against Stefano, who's an experienced campaigner and very quick. And I didn't realize till sort of years later, I'm talking to the mechanics that were back there in the time. They said, well, your problem, mate, you ended up getting his secondhand parts on the car. So he was the number one, and I was essentially the number two, but I never really got the sort of same stuff as he did. And at the time I didn't really know, but sometimes we were like really close, but he was always just ahead of me. And sometimes that was the difference between qualifying and not qualifying, you know. So it was a tough year. It helped me in some way, I guess, get the next drive, if you know what I mean, because I was a Jaguar sports car driver, and part of those decisions, you know, they look at your CV, they look at what you've done. And, you know, I at least I had done Formula One. And yes, it wasn't successful, but my career previous to that was. Yeah. So don't write me off too quickly. And then got into the World Sports Car Championship with Jaguar, the XJR14, working with Tom Walkinshaw and Ross Brawn and the guys. And, you know, I ended up finishing first and second in my first World Sports Car event because I drove both cars, started in one and finished in the other and finished 1-2. So that launched my sports car career.
Yeah, I've got to ask about Ross Brawn. I mean, he's I guess a relatively private bloke. You know, we don't hear too much about him, but everyone's heard of him. What was he like to work with? I imagine he's a man with a very, very big brain.
Yeah, he was good because, you know, obviously, I don't think many people probably realise, but that was the last car he ever designed himself.
Okay.
So he took a different role after that, where this one was his baby. And the thing was phenomenal. It was so fast. When I joined, it was ridiculously quick compared to everything else. And to be fair, Peugeot caught up. They built a new car, and all of a sudden it was like we were struggling to beat them.
Yeah.
But it was a great environment. It was, you know, going from the sort of chaos of Brabham to a well-structured, funded team that had Ross at the helm there, who was very quiet, allowed everyone to speak, but when he spoke, he spoke with authority, knowledge, not trying to be overpowering because he allowed it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I have others to speak. And he was just really easy and good to work with from my memories of those times. So I've always had a good relationship with Ross. Every time we see each other, we have a chat. You know, from that moment onwards, you know, we knew each other, and unfortunately I never worked with him after that. I would have liked to, like a lot of drivers for sure. But, you know, he went on to amazing things after that.
Yeah, incredible. And when you look back at those Le Mans days, I mean, one of the greatest races on the planet, probably one of the top three races on the planet, but, you know, alongside things like the Indy 500 and Monaco Grand Prix. It's an incredibly long and challenging experience. You've got to drive in the middle of the night in pitch black. It's all scary and quick and foggy and crazy weather systems. What was it like emotionally taking part in a race as challenging as that?
Well, I don't think I ever had a more challenging Le Mans. I did 18 of them, and the most challenging was my first one. And that was because I was a third driver. I didn't really get enough time in practice to learn the circuit as much as I would have liked, so I was still learning it. Jeff Lee started the event, ended up, it was absolutely bucketing down with rain on the start. He got involved in an accident down the Mulsanne Straight on lap one, into the barriers, half the car missing, comes back into the pits, long time to repair it. So we're out of the race essentially at that point. And then by the time I get in the car as the third driver, it's pitch black, it's thick fog, and it's bucketing down with rain. I couldn't see a thing. So there was no safety car. You know, I went out of the pits, and I can always remember Jeff Lee's when he came in during his stint. I was listening to the radio, and he just said, "You guys are not paying me enough to be in this car." And when I went out there and went down the Mulsanne Straight for the first time, I didn't get out of third gear. I couldn't see where I was going. It was just these white lines. I didn't know if anyone's in front of me. And, you know, I look back and I think, "Oh, you wuss," you know. But it was just scary. I just didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, you couldn't see. It was absolutely bucking with rain. I didn't know if it was going to aquaplane. It was thick fog, and we're still racing.
Yeah,
you know, today's world, that would be, you know, under safety car and it would be too dangerous. But back then it was like, you know, get on with it. Why are you slow? You know, what's happening? You know, so no one actually passed me on that first lap, which was interesting. And then the second lap, I just was flat out down the Mulsanne looking at the white lines in front of me, because sitting in the crown in the middle, and then waiting for a marker on the left to show me where I could start to brake.
But that's so dangerous, though, isn't it? I mean, you're flat out following a white line. You can't see anything. If a car has had a mechanical fault in front of you, you're a goner. Like, there is no coming back from that. It's just insane. What was it like when you crossed the line and you get your first win in Le Mans? That must be one of the highlights of your career.
Yeah, I mean, the second year I went back, so that's my first one was 92. So 93 was the Jaguar XJ220. And, we were having a good battle with Hans Stuck in the Porsche, and they ended up crashing, I think. So that was the end of them. So it was up to us to really to get to the end. And during that race, I actually had a fuel leak inside the car.
Oh my God.
And, I got on the radio and said, my feet are slipping and I've got a real strong smell of fuel, you know. And they said, "Well, can you get to the end of the stint?" And I was getting a headache and everything. So I came in after a few laps, and they filled up with fuel. And then they said, "Right, we found the leak. Would you mind going and doing a few more laps so we can figure out what to do with it, whether we need to change the tank or not?" Well, I told them to F off, and I said, "You change the tank because I am not going out." And okay. So they changed the tank and off we went. Anyway, we ended up winning the race with DC and John Nilsson. And, you know, which was great. My brother Jeff had won the race overall for Peugeot, so it was a huge family affair on the day. You know, it was only later on we got disqualified because it was under appeal anyway. While we raced, which was a shame, because it was a great challenge for us to try and get to the front and keep there, and you know, with the other cars around, and you just had to have a few problems and you know, you were done. So that was my first experience of standing on the podium, Le Mans, which is something you'll never forget.
I mean, despite the disqualification, you still had that experience of standing on the podium at Le Mans in front of all
absolutely
those fans. You know,
yeah.
So, you know.
My dad was there, and he was there with two of his sons and just won Le Mans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So, insane. Yeah, amazing. And just fast forwarding and then a little bit more, following a second stint in Formula One, you did some British Touring Car Championships, back into Le Mans, had some more success. But before we come on to more recent history, I'm keen to get your thoughts on Formula One now. And obviously Liberty Media came in a few years ago, changed things up a little bit, and they've mixed things up. We've got some new regulations coming in. We've got a great driver battle. What's your take on Formula One now? Do you like it? Do you look back at the old days and think, "I liked it better then"? What's your take on the current racing?
I would say that, I guess I'm probably one of those people that look back and think the racing back then was quite raw. The tracks were dangerous. There was a different vibe in the paddock as such. Today's Formula One is very different. The cars are technically just amazing. They really are, from a performance point of view. The drivers seem to get younger and younger. You know, they're hardly out of nappies and they're driving quickly on a Formula One car can win a world championship. I mean, I went into Formula One when I was 24 and I was the second youngest driver on the grid. I think the average was over 30. You know what I mean? It was very different to today's world. I think the evolution of the way the cars have gone and the drivers in terms of their performances, the way they go about it, their fitness, everything just goes up and up and up in level. So that's impressive to watch from the outside. And of course, it's always more interesting when you've got a bit of a battle on track. The Lewis Max show that we've seen building up over the last few years to this kind of moment is fascinating. You know, it's drawn a lot of people in. I think Liberty coming in at the time that they did, everyone was probably a bit unsure to begin with. But if you look fast forward to where they are now, you know, I kind of feel they came in at the right time with the right vision. The fans have got more connected, more involved. Obviously, social media has played a big role in that. They didn't have it in my day, but certainly I think a lot of positives are coming out of Formula One, and with the new regulations and cost cap and things like that, it starts to make a bit more sense as well from a, let's say if you're a business and you're looking at Formula One as a business, it's starting to make a little bit more sense now as well. So I think the future looks pretty good for Formula One, to be fair.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think the first couple of years of Liberty's reign, I think there was still a lot of Formula One bashing going on, and gradually over the last few years, it seems to have tailed off. And I think people are actually falling back in love with the sport again. I think a lot of people fell out of love with it, and it became
absolutely. I would put myself in that category as well.
Agreed. Well, let's talk. Let's shift focus and talk about Brabham Automotive. I don't know if you remember this. I don't know how many years ago it was. It was before the BT62, before any wheels were made, any bits and pieces were created. I was in a room with you in, I think it was London Wall, in an office of some investment firm, and you were looking for funds to get going with Brabham Automotive and get going with the BT62. And the meeting we had, I can't remember the chap I was dealing with, but we talked around it. Can we help with any fundraising and stuff? And it came to nothing. But it's funny that we sit here now, and that during that period of time, that what you've gone on to achieve is incredible. You've got the project off the ground. You've got a car that is available as a track car, but it's also going into racing. It seems to have happened pretty quickly. For those that don't know, tell us a little bit of the backstory behind Brabham Automotive and the BT62.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I mean, if I go back a little bit further, it really started when I got to age 40 and I'm thinking, what am I going to do when I'm 50? Because I didn't feel like, I felt like I needed something, and I felt that we got an iconic racing name. What do we do with that? You know, we weren't doing anything with it. So I started to think way ahead down the road and try and figure out, how do I take an iconic racing name and turn it into a brand? You know, so the two are quite different. So I ended up going through the legal court case to get the name back. That took 7 years. Started with a clean sheet of paper. I looked at the kind of Virgin model. You know, so you've got the brand, and you've got the brand is used as an accelerator to market for different projects. You know, so if you look at Virgin Trains, Virgin Money, Virgin this, Virgin that. I thought, could I do the similar model to that for Brabham? You know, so it was about then finding the right partners, the right investors for a project that would get the name back out there. And a mutual friend of mine and the investors that invested in Brabham Automotive, Fusion Capital out of Adelaide, a mutual contact said, look, you guys should meet. So we met up, and fast forward a couple of years, we created Brabham Automotive and the BT62, which we took to market at Australia House in May 2nd of 2018. And then, you know, people got a chance to drive the car. They really loved it. All the journalists raved about it. People said, could we race it? Can we put it on the road? So within we're only building 70 of the BT62s. And it is the ultimate track car originally. You know, it's 1,200 kilos downforce. It's under a ton in weight, 700 horsepower, ABS traction control and carbon brakes, you know. So the ultimate game was to break the lap record at Bathurst, which we achieved. And now we've got, obviously, Paul Bailey's been racing one and will race one next year in GT Cup. So that's because people said, can we race them? So it's like, well, okay, we looked at that. And also, can we put them on the road? So the BT62R is a road-compliant conversion of the BT62. So we've got customers for those. And the first one went to New Zealand, and it's just going through the registration process at the moment. And there's one coming to Europe. There's more in Australia. So that's all starting to build. And then we came up with the BT63 GT2 car, which I raced now a couple of months ago at Paul Ricard for the SRO Fanatec GT2 European Series. So that's the kind of next phase for us. It's more, let's say, racing dedicated than, the 62. And, you know, we've got some exciting plans that we're working on for next year and beyond around that particular project. Now, ultimately, we want to get to Le Mans and race a Brabham at Le Mans. But I always say to people, that's our vision.
Yeah.
We have to build the business to the point where we're able to support a program like that. And as you know, they're big, expensive programs, and a lot of the big manufacturers are able to do it. Smaller ones, it's a bit harder. But it doesn't mean to say we're not going to achieve it. So we're building the business up. That goal's getting closer as we move along. And it's exciting times, really. Very excited for me to be part of that project and also to be able to create something that carries the Brabham name into the future and creates the next chapter and rebuilds the house that my father built,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, you know? Very cool. And it would be so amazing for that to almost go full circle and you have a Brabham car potentially driven by another Brabham crossing the line at Le Mans. I mean, absolutely fantastic stuff. Many congratulations, yeah, for all of that. And you mentioned keeping that Brabham name going. And there are some younger Brabhams doing all right on racetrack. Are you pleased that your son, I think your nephew races as well, are you pleased, yeah, that they're going in this direction? Or are you a bit like your dad was with you and rolling your eyes thinking, oh, Christ, here we go again?
You know, it's kind of funny with my son. I mean, obviously, Jeff's boy, Matthew, had started a lot earlier than when Sam did. So, but with Sam, he started to get a bit of an interest in wanting to do something at age 14, 15. And I found myself doing similar things to what my dad did with me, which kind of scared me a little bit. It was like, really? Because at first he'd say it, and I guess I didn't take it that seriously. You know, a bit like my dad did with me. It's not something I consciously did. It was just kind of how it happened. And I think it was life's way of saying, well, you know, you need to open your eyes a bit on what happened with your dad and you. And now you're seeing it through the mirror of you and your son, you know. And I remember flying to America because I was busy racing in America at that time with American Le Mans Series. And I remember looking out the window, which I loved doing when I was flying over there because, you know, lots of creative things come to your head. And that voice said, don't be an idiot. Just, you know, you're being a prick. Just get him in a go-kart. And so when I came back, we did. And so he ended up doing go-karting, Formula Ford, you know, Porsche Carrera Cup, and then went to Australia for a visit and hasn't come back after 2.5 years. So he's... Unfortunately, COVID down there scuppered a racing project for him, and now he's building that back up and wants to race in Australia. And you've got Matthew racing in America. He's done a few tests in an Indy Lights program, so hopefully he can get in and do a season of that again just to get kickstart his career in single seaters and get to IndyCar. I mean, I'd love to see, you know, both of them in a Brabham racing at Le Mans, you know,
amazing.
And standing on the podium. That would be amazing because, you know, my dad started that at Le Mans by winning the first ever Grand Prix at Le Mans, the French Grand Prix in 1967. And then my brother and I have won Le Mans. And so to have a Brabham car on track winning Le Mans with Brabhams in it, it'd be a fairy tale story, and that's the dream. That's what we're going.
That would finish everybody off. If anyone that knows, anyone that knows motorsport, I think that would, if you don't shed a tear, then you are literally dead inside. So now you're obviously a very quick racing driver. You've become a businessman.
Was
a very quick racing driver. You've become a businessman. You're very good at that. You know, things were heading in a good direction. What are you crap at? What are you absolutely useless at?
Oh God, everything else. there's lots of things that you could say, okay, I'm okay at, but there's lots of things it's just not my bag. You know, I'm not good at. I couldn't say anything too much. I mean, to be fair, when I first started cooking, I was a crap person at cooking, but I actually quite enjoy it now and I'm getting better at it. My wife's a good cook and my son, Finn, who's 21, is an outstanding cook. You know, so when he's at home and I'm cooking, I feel massively under pressure.
And let's flip that on its head. Any hidden talents, anything that you're particularly good at outside of your racing and on-track exploits?
I think if I go back to like the conversation I had earlier when I was at school and I played a lot of sport, I can pick up sporty stuff really quickly. And I think that's been good for me going on, you know. I like playing golf, but I don't play enough to be good at it. But an example, I guess, is I was living next door to the 1991 European champion, a guy called Jeff Hawkes, I think his name was. And he asked me to do a golfing charity match. And I said, well, you give me some lessons, you know, because I was okay at golf, but pretty average, you know, shooting high 90s, that kind of thing. And he gave me four lessons and we played together. And after the first nine holes, we were both on four over par. So it, with a bit of guidance and stuff, you know, I can pick things up quite naturally. So that's where I would say I was always born with something to be able to do that.
Yeah, fantastic. Now that we have a final three questions that we ask all of our guests, and they throw up a myriad of different answers. And these are brought to us by our friends at Rodin Cars. The first one, what's got you excited at this very moment?
I think, you try and think, oh, what could that be? But it's that first thing that kind of comes to your head. And I kind of feel that all the work that I've done in the background over the last 16 years to get, let's say, the Brabham brand to where we are today with Brabham Automotive, we've got some other things that we're working on in the background, and you can start to see light at the end of the tunnel in terms of where it's all headed. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting. It's not been easy to get to where we are today, you know, the court case and, you know, starting an automotive company from scratch is not easy. A lot of challenges, but we keep hitting the milestones, although a little bit further down the road than we probably first thought. COVID didn't help, but also just unrealistic timing. It's coming together. And for someone like myself, you know, you say, well, you're good at business. I'm still learning about business, to be fair. I find if I go into the, when I went looking for money and talking to people in a world that it's a language I didn't understand, it was a bit of a shock. You know what I mean? It was like, well, what's all this about? Because that's not how we act or behave or talk in racing. I went into very different worlds that I had to learn very quickly. That was very challenging, you know. So I'm still learning. I like to keep to certain principles, which is if it doesn't make sense, why, you know? And that's kept me kind of on an even keel as I've learned and gone along, because I kind of feel a lot of people lose sight of common sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm a kind of common sense person, you know. So you know, if I was to go back when I was a kid and said, this is what you've done in your life, I just forget it, you know. It's just, there's no way, you know. So I look at that journey. And yeah, it's great, and I feel like I've achieved a lot, but I still feel there's more to go. There's still more to do, and that's the bit I'm excited about, is what's next.
And had you not gone down this path, if you had never found racing, what would you be doing right now?
Well, I guess it would have been farming.
Yeah.
Whether I liked it or not, it just kind of, well, that's how it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. And finally, what are you scared of?
That's a really, really good question, isn't it? The fear is, what do they say? Fear is false expectations appearing real. You know, it's a good statement, and I think it's easy to have fears about the unknown and the risks that you've got to take into the unknown. And I, when I look back, and I think I was quite a conservative person when I was racing, in a sense. And going through the court case was a massive challenge for me personally, financially and emotionally. But that broke that mold a little bit, where I started to take more risk. I started to push myself a bit more in areas that I perhaps wouldn't have done. So for me, it was about breaking those barriers, internal fear barriers, I guess. Yeah.
I think it's a really interesting question. It's a very simple question, but I think you can tell a lot about an individual about their answer, because some people we've asked that question to over 100 people now on this podcast, and some people just go, spiders. You think, okay, fair enough, you know, fine. Yeah. Others, people like Freddie Hunt, for example, couldn't answer. It choked him up. Because yeah. We'd obviously talked about his father a little bit, and he was like, I don't think I can talk about it. So he left it. And others went quite deep into it, and it throws up all sorts of fascinating answers.
If you're talking very generic, what are you scared of from an animal point of view? Yeah, it would be a snake.
Yeah, well,
I hate snakes. And I lived on a farm, and I had snakes going between my legs. Yeah, I've had snakes nearly bite me, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, from that side, it's snakes. But I think it's in a deeper sense, it's kind of those inner little battles you have with yourself to progress.
Yeah, no, agreed. Well, listen, we've kept you for long enough, but fascinating story. There's so much that we didn't talk about. You know, you've done an awful lot in your career. But best of luck with Brabham Automotive. Best of luck with the car and future iterations of that car and all the racing that's to come. David Brabham, thank you for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Tim. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out Rodin Cars. Forget a one-off experience. With Rodin and the Rodin FZ, you can become and live the life of an elite performance driver. With your very own Rodin FZ, you'll be able to drive a truly remarkable supercar. Hunt down lap time and search for ultimate performance. A solo cockpit, but never alone. With Rodin's incredible after-sale partnership, you'll be looked after on and off track with an official Formula Racing team running and maintaining your vehicle. And as an exclusive owner of a Rodin car, you'll get exclusive access to their circuit in New Zealand. So, what are you waiting for? To find out how you can own the F1 lifestyle, find the perfect racing line, enjoy the thrill of a roaring engine, and experience the purity of driving, visit rodin-cars.com. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out out how you can help cure brain tumours quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.